Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take up Sandhill Cranes to begin the program today. You know, about 100 years ago, Sandhill Cranes had nearly disappeared from Wisconsin's landscape. They've made a comeback so significant they are blamed for causing significant crop damage. And with us today are three members of the legislative study committee that was formed to look at Sandhill Cranes and act on some proposals relating to them. One of the people is with us. Who is with us is Paul Waite. Paul is communications manager for the Delta Waterfowl Foundation. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, appreciate your presence. Melissa Johnson, another of our guests, is the executive director of Wisconsin's Green Fire. Melissa, thank you for joining in.
My absolute pleasure, Larry.
And Todd Schaller is the board of directors of both the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association and the Wisconsin Conservation and Education Foundation. Todd, thank you for joining in.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
As we talk with our three guests, who were both all three citizen members of the committee, I hope you'll join in. Give us a thought. Give us a call about your thoughts on Sandhill Cranes. Number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Just by way of a sort of a general introduction, legislative study committees, in my understanding, are held every 2 years on a handful of topics. They typically develop one or more draft bills for possible introduction to the legislature. And the committee you served on, the 12-member legislative study committee, had to do with Sandhill Cranes. I think there were four legislators, two Democrats and two Republicans, and eight citizen members from conservation and farming groups. So that's kind of the background of the committee. Melissa, what was the committee's overall charge?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you for asking. The overall charge was to evaluate, my understanding at least, to evaluate the potential for a hunt of sandhill cranes, and in particular, with a rationale underscoring the damage that the cranes are doing to crops, particularly corn. They apparently like the seed very, very much, and their habitat is adjacent to cornfields. So that was my understanding and my interest in trying to balance that interest of our farming community and, of course, our conservation community. So that's what initiated all of the discussion over the course of several months.
Yeah, you met five times. I read a piece from Paul Smith, who was writing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he said, "Testimony over the first three meetings made it clear that there would be no easy or complete solutions." Paul,
as
what
with
was
all sticky solutions? Ahead. There isn't. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. That's all right, Melissa. It was a tough time.
It was.
Paul, a comment on that? I mean, you must have heard some pretty impassioned talks from people on all sides of the issue.
We did, but we also heard, you know, a lot of science from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Wisconsin DNR, from the International Crane Foundation, and other interested groups. You know, so we got a really good dive into, you know, the population dynamics of cranes. And then also we heard from farm groups and about the damage that was being caused by cranes. And so, you know, I think we, you know, I was privileged to be on this committee. We got a real good, well-rounded look at not only the problem, if you will, but we got to look under the hood of what sandhill cranes are doing in Wisconsin. So And certainly there's passion on a lot of people's part, both for and against the hunt. And, you know, part of the charge here was to figure out what we could do to help the state's farmers.
Yeah. How significant is the problem, the crop damage problem by sandhill cranes, Paul?
Yeah, so what we heard was that conservatively, it's right around $1.9 million a year damage to crops. About half of that was corn, and then almost half was potatoes, but there were some other things too, wheat and cranberries and a few other fruit, beans, I guess, some other crops. And the amount of damage is growing. Along with the population of cranes, it's also growing. So this situation is continuing to be worse and worse for farmers. And, you know, so that's why I believe the study committee was formed, was to try to find solutions to help the farmers out and also to provide hunting opportunity if the resource can sustain it. And we found out that it can.
Yeah, and Todd, to get you involved here, the you voted on a few draft bills. What were the bills that you voted on?
There was, you know, three bills that were kind of talked through. One was a standalone reimbursement program, cost share for Avapel. The second one was a bill that would authorize hunting, and then thus by authorizing hunting, it would open up the agricultural depredation program. And then the third was really those two bills in combination. And that's the bill that we ultimately voted in support of, 8-4 with some amendments. But those were the three bills. So it's three bills, but all very similar. Like I said, two standalone, and then the one kind of taking a more multi-strategy approach to the conversation and the challenge.
Yeah. Melissa, just I don't know how much you know about the history, but a century ago, sandhill cranes, as I mentioned earlier, were almost hunted out of existence. Their comeback has been monumental.
Well, I'm not quite 100 years old, but
no, neither am
some
I.
People think, yeah, but I remember growing up in Wisconsin, and I never saw a sandhill crane. And I remember the first time seeing one here in central Wisconsin where I live. And it was, you know, a stunning moment. And conservation efforts, obviously, have worked. And I'm ever so grateful for that, because I'd like my grandchildren and my grandchildren's grandchildren to enjoy these birds. So, you know, kudos to everybody who put that early work into ensuring their protection. Of course, Endangered Species Act underpins a lot of that, and we need to ensure its vitality. I just want to add in one thing. The one thing we did learn, and I asked this question very, very early on, I think it was your first meeting, and I asked it of DNR, former DNR person, will a spring hunt or a hunt in the fall impact corn damage in the spring? And the answer was no. So I think there was this early kind of division of how do we best address corn damage and then pull apart that hunting sort of concept. So the two were linked in our mission, our charge,
sure.
But we quickly pulled them apart as separate issues.
And I understand farmers can get depredation permits to shoot sandhill cranes in their fields. Is that, and of course, that is taking care of a problem right when it happens, but is this not enough?
Yeah, absolutely. They can get depredation permits, and that's one of the contentious things for me, actually. So, not that I want farmers not to have a remedy or a method, but yeah, in 2023, 1,405 sandhill cranes were killed under depredation permits in Wisconsin, which was what we learned. And because of Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the way the federal government handles things, those birds cannot be utilized. So the farmer who shoots them to get them to stop damaging their corn crop, they have to leave the bird lay in the field or throw it in the dumpster. They cannot utilize those birds. So, and that number, the number of birds that are being taken on those damage permits continues to rise.
Hmm. Well, so, somebody mentioned, maybe it was you, Todd, that mentioned Avapel. Can you talk about Avapel and applied to corn seed?
Sure. I mean, Avapel is a product that has been produced that is basically put on the seed. A farmer puts it on the seed prior to planting. And then because ultimately the spring damage from cranes is basically they're actually eating the corn seed itself. So they use that big long bill and stick it down and grab that corn seed when it's still kind of in that early stages of seed. So Avapel is a deterrent to that, that has some effect in, a crane that, grabs a seed or two, or, we think we heard variety of numbers, but doesn't like that taste and then quits feeding on that product. So it has some effectiveness. International Crane Foundation was part in kind of developing and testing it. Obviously, it comes at a cost to farmers, and we learned about that cost. So it's additional cost, which from an agricultural perspective impacts their bottom line. And in the ag world, when you're working on tight margins to begin with, anything that adds additional cost obviously shrinks that and makes that margin even tighter.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to take a quick little break here. Paul Waite, Senior Manager of Communications for Delta Waterfowl and editor of the organization's magazine, Melissa Johnson, Executive Director of Wisconsin's Green Fire, and Todd Schaller, Board President of the Wisconsin Conservation and Education Foundation, all members of the 12-member Legislative Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes. We'll give you a chance to join in now. If you'd like to weigh in, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. We're talking about sandhill cranes and the legislative study committee on sandhill cranes. Three members of the committee, Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schaller, are guests today, and they were all citizen members of that committee. Questions, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Karen emailed to say Karen watched or attended all five of the Sandhill Crane Legislative Committee meetings and as a result has two questions. Number one, why weren't the changes that were discussed and agreed upon during the fourth meeting not added to the summary of findings? And two, there's a list of ways that the items in the summary were misrepresented, not totally factual, or missing context. Why was this list not included in the summary? Melissa, we'll turn to you first.
Sure, we can do a round robin with that. So the summary of the findings were really a product of the chair's notes and a couple of other people's notes. They weren't an official summary coming from the legislative staff. And I think probably as with all notes, and I'm just going to be fair here, sometimes we miss things in notes and we miss context. We were presented with a lot of information. The notes, I think, did miss necessary context. There was information from Ann Lacey, who works for the Crane Foundation, who tried to clarify things, and then Mr. Jeb Barzan, an expert in crane biology. So I'm not sure we had asked for them to be included in, and ultimately those corrections were, or that additional context was not approved for ultimately including in the official record. I voted to oppose adding it to the official record because it was not produced by legislative staff. It was produced as a part of notes. So, oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Paul, anything to add to that?
Yeah. So that wasn't really up to, you know, that was the chair of the committee that kind of steered that and decided that. But I also would note that if you do go to the website, all of Ann Lacey's comments are in a document in there. So they are part of the work product of the meetings. So it's not like they were erased from the record. They are there. But you do have to search for them and find that specific document to find those, that extra context. I think part of what happened was we just, as a committee, we didn't want to spend more time debating some of the points that were put forward and some of that context and definitions of words and languages and things. So I think that's what happened, but I can't speak for the entire group, but that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah. Todd, anything to add there?
No, I would agree. I think that's kind of, particularly in the fourth meeting, you know, we were trying to work our way through it, and it was clear, I guess, that was probably going to take all of the fourth meeting and maybe five and six and seven to kind of come to a final consensus. But so the focus turned to the bills that were drafted at that point in time and kind of work through that. Because if you look at what we were asked to do, that really is, you know, was the ask is, you know, propose potential legislation to provide some management strategies for sandhill cranes, looking at agricultural damage and, you know, a hunting opportunity and all that. So I think in the end, that part was accomplished, and that was our primary charge.
Yeah. Timothy and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks, Timothy, for calling.
Morning, Larry. Yes, I have a couple of just thoughts here I'd like to mention for the gentleman that, you know, sandhill cranes are really special to a lot of people here in Wisconsin, and I think especially anybody who's read a Sand County Almanac. And I did attend most of those meetings, so I had a chance to sit in and listen to the testimony and found that it was very heavily weighed towards the comments of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, which has been promoting the season all year. Now, I'm a hunter and an avid waterfowl hunter, but the only testimony that I heard really that was invited from the public was with the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, and I wish they would have invited many of the hunters who are opposed to a hunting season. And I guess I would just ask the guests here, number one, why would they vote for a bill that would require the state to have a season but not allow it to go through the Natural Resources Board, which is where most of our hunting seasons are set? And why would they not consider that since wildlife belongs to all of us, the crop damage law, in essence, it requires a hunting season in order to pay crop damage to farmers. Why would they not consider a bill which would allow general tax money to pay for that and not require a hunting season? So I'd be interested in how the gentlemen know what they think about that. Thank you, Larry.
All right. Thank you for calling. So I'm not sure who wants to take that to begin with.
Larry, I'll maybe
Todd
start the conversation.
Sure.
Sure. So Tim's very aware of the process for establishing seasons. And the first step of that process is for the legislature to authorize the ability for a season. The next step is, and that the legislation as it's laid out, then turns it over to the Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and on the Department of Natural Resources, the Natural Resource Board, to help establish what that season looks like. So we don't in Wisconsin, the Natural Resource Board is part of the rulemaking process, but they also have to be provided the authority to look at that. So, you know, if this continues to move forward, the Natural Resource Board and the DNR rulemaking process will be involved in part of that. So I think that's, you know, that's like that or not, that is the process we have in the state of Wisconsin. So that addresses the first part of what Tim had indicated. And, you know, I guess to add on that, that then includes additional public input process. So that's a, I believe, a win in all our minds. So, you know, the fact that, you know, not everybody would support or hunters support or don't support or would hunt or not hunt really isn't the question that we were tasked with. It was to develop some management strategies addressing agricultural damage for sandhill cranes. I think part of that is we also need to recognize that if we have a constitutional right in Wisconsin to hunt, fish, and trap. So we need to keep that in mind as we continue to talk about this. And I'm a hunter too, but I don't hunt all species. And I don't necessarily like the way we do hunt some species. But I'm not going to engage in prohibiting that if it's one, sound management to hunt that species, authorized by law to hunt that species. Again, I fall back to the constitutional aspect of that.
Yeah. Melissa, care to chime in?
Sure. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Todd, for your response. And thanks, Tim, for the question. First of all, I did not vote in favor of the bill. I voted against it for a number of reasons. But I just want to quickly say that the constitutional right that Todd spoke about is very clear. But it is subject only to reasonable restrictions as prescribed by law. And I'm reading right from the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's kind of why we don't hunt raptors like hawks and eagles and owls. So there's always got to be a reasonable framework by which our rights are granted to us. Early on, I had just indicated that we learned that a sandhill crane hunt would have little to no impact on the corn depredation for farmers. So then I had asked myself, what is the problem we're trying to fix? And it was apparent that there were some people interested in a crane hunt. I understand that. I used to be a hunter. I'm not anymore. I don't have time, and it's rather expensive. But in that, we should have a management plan. And in 2009, there was a management plan for sandhill crane. Again, talking about it's their populations, and if we were to have a hunt, what should that population be at? That plan was supposed to be updated every 5 years. It has not been updated in 15 years. And in 15 years, we know that things have changed. And what we were hearing from our experts is that the population seems to be leveling off for whatever reason. We have some inconsistencies with how we measure the crane population using a couple of different methodologies, and that's fine. But, you know, in 2024, the crane population was counted at 83,649 birds, yet in 2023, it was counted at 111,639. So, and this is from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we know there's data gaps. I'm not opposed to a hunt. What I'm opposed to is a lack of an updated management plan to help guide that. And that's done by DNR and experts. So again, not opposed to a hunt. I hope this discussion will net itself an updated crane management plan.
Ah, all right. Paul, did you want to add anything as well?
Yeah, so the Fish and Wildlife Service data on the eastern population of sandhill cranes that was released on the 20th of August in their status update that they put out every year says that there's 110,000 sandhill cranes and that it increased 4% from the previous year, and it's been increasing at a rate of 4.4%. annually. So I'm not sure where the 83,000 number comes from. I've never seen that number. That was not presented to us by any of the experts either. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to dispute you on that, Lisa. and it also, the population, as we were told by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and DNR folks, is not really leveling off. It's expanding outside of Wisconsin. The eastern population of sandhill cranes is expanding in range and size and number. So, yeah, I'm not sure where that 83,000 thing came from. But,
I thank you for your comments as well. Mark in Neosho has something that relates to kind of what all we've been talking about here the last few minutes. Mark, comments?
Good morning, Larry. Thanks, everyone, for allowing me to participate. First of all, I've been involved in migratory conservation and the rule process for over 35 years. I think I have a fairly good understanding. And one of the things that's important is that 83% of the Wisconsin voters supported the constitutional right to hunt, fish, and trap and take game, only subject, like Melissa said, to reasonable restrictions. Melissa's comments in regards to raptors are irrelevant because there's no season, nor can there be a season on raptors. And one of the things that there is, that there is no clause that says, except for if there is a legal hunting season or can be a legal hunting season, it was the basis of that constitutional act. The second thing is a question and fact sheet was submitted by David Scott from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that eliminated any question by reasonable doubt in regards to whether or not an updated management plan should have any impact on whether or not Wisconsin has a sandhill crane season. And I think the exact verbiage in that article was, to the question, absolutely not. Now, I don't know what science or whose science people have used to refute the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but it's important to understand that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the acknowledged professional and authority on migratory birds, right? They are the ones that set the guidelines, as well as the rule and framework that the flyway uses to create these hunting seasons. And, you know, when it comes to the representation on this committee, you know, Greenfire, part of their mission statement is the support of science-based management of natural resources. One of the folks on their or in their organization served on the Migratory Council for well over 20 years, and I'm sure that person would not doubt the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service science on the matter. And I think that if everybody looked at that question and answer statement, these questions have clear answers, and they're supported by everybody in the flyway.
All right. Mark brings a lot to the discussion here, and I'd like to get some response or at least comments from everybody. Melissa, start with you, I guess.
Certainly. Let's start with, there is no biological reason to not have a hunt, okay? There is no biological reason to have a hunt. I mean, if that's the starting point. Moving from there, the science, deciding to have a hunt is really a political, social, and cultural decision, right? Mm-hmm. It is typically rooted in our history and our traditions and, of course, the framework of law. From a science perspective, the Fish and Wildlife Service did say, yeah, there have you can support a hunt up to, I think it was about 4%. But then we also got a piece of our document from an individual who was part of the Eastern Flyway Planning, a professor out of Tennessee, who said that it's important to update that information because of the way we measure the population and some of the other factors, like a lower fledge rate than we used to have. And it's that measurement. We are using a couple of different ways to measure the population at different locations. And that's where we get this range, everywhere from that low point to the high point I just mentioned. So again, the science comes in, the data comes in, and the work of Greenfire, like I said, I am not opposed to it. I would love to see that updated plan. I don't like the cart before the horse. I think if we had an updated plan, I think some of the reservations of some folks might go away, because we can reassure through that updated plan that we're doing no harm, that we're doing the best job possible for this incredible species.
Yeah. Paul, we'll have you chime in. Paul?
Yeah. So just the Fish and Wildlife Service has, or did let the committee know that they are working on that update to the plan. Another point here is that in the current management plan, the threshold to have a hunt was established at 30,000 cranes in the eastern population. And again, this is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service numbers. They said that the eastern population of sandhill cranes is at 110,000. So we're 3.7 times that threshold on the low end to have a hunt. And the population, again, continues to increase by 4% per year of the eastern population of sandhill cranes. So we're way above a threshold at which a hunting season could happen, and also would possibly, you know, cause any concern of anyone about that as far as what a hunt might do. You got to understand, too, the hunt that would be authorized for Wisconsin, and this is, again, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR, would result in maybe 1,000 or so cranes being harvested a year. And for me, we're shooting 1,400 of them in the spring and leaving them lay in a cornfield. And as a hunter and a conservationist, that hurts me a little bit. I'd like to be able to utilize that resource in a constructive way as a huntable species. And also, they're excellent table fare. So I would like the opportunity in Wisconsin to have a hunt here. And by the way, cranes are hunted in 17 states of the United States currently, and also two or three Canadian provinces. So it's not that Wisconsin would be, you know, breaking new ground here to have a hunting season for sandhill cranes.
Yeah. And Todd, anything to add to what Melissa and Paul have said?
The only thing I'd add is, as Paul indicated, in the David Scott from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, that indicated that they're underway of developing a new plan or an updated plan. What underway means in the federal government, you know, we're all probably not sure. But I think one thing to keep in mind is this process, our process to establish a season in Wisconsin, is a very long process. So first off, you know, we've just kicked a bill out of a study committee for consideration in the political process. If that moves just through our political process, that's probably a year plus. If that gets approved, the department has to establish a management plan and a hunt plan that ultimately needs to be approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's another probably year to two, probably two minimum, on top of that. So we have, even if we were to streamline this through the system, there's probably 2 plus 3 years before we would ever have a hunt in Wisconsin. Hopefully, like Melissa and others, hopefully the Fish and Wildlife Service has established or re-established that plan renewed that plan. And if at any point there was concerns or red flags, that would be identified, and it would be. And then we would either have to step back or modify what that hunt looks like. So I think we all want the plan updated, but we also, even moving forward with this concept, we have time for that plan to be updated and then obviously implemented or influenced what the end product looks like.
Let's give Linda and Cable a chance to join in. Linda, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I missed the beginning of your program, but I want to put in my nickel's worth. I live out in the woods, but I have two huge fields on either side of my driveway. And every spring, these redheaded cranes come, and they hang out for like 3 weeks. And they are such a pleasure to watch because they're doing their mating dance. And I just put on some symphony music and watch them because I stay home and I can sew and watch them. And it's such a pleasure, and I hope they don't slaughter them all and I can still see them till I die.
All right, Linda, thanks for calling. I don't know if anybody wants to chime in on that. Melissa, you want to chime?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Linda, I'd love to come up to Cable and sit on your front porch and listen to the music and watch the birds.
Todd, you were going to say something.
Yeah, and same thing. I think, you know, everybody on the committee, you know, is one recognizes the uniqueness of the sandhill cranes, the amazing conservation story that comes with the sandhill cranes. And I think in the end, even if Wisconsin were to have a hunt, I think understand that from the day-to-day perspective of enjoying cranes, seeing cranes fly, listening to your music while watching them there with their breeding dance, that probably doesn't change. You know, it doesn't change at all because the current structure under the current management plan is the harvest would be very managed, very controlled. And again, on a day-to-day perspective, we're going to continue to see cranes, enjoy cranes, you know, all times of the year in Wisconsin, and particularly with our warming winters, even now, I've been seeing cranes the last several days in Wisconsin, even though we're in the heart of winter and they should be down south.
Yeah, I've been seeing them too. It's always an amazing sight for sure. Stephen Stoughton had something. We'll give him a chance to join in. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning, and thank you. Look, I don't understand why a crane hunt is tied to an ag bill. At all. The premise is that cranes cause damage to the corn farmers, but I looked at the numbers and apparently it's $2 million worth of damage a year, but our corn harvest is like $2 billion a year. And so that's like a 0.1%. So I don't really think that 0.1% is really harming when the value of the cranes are so high. So that's one thing. But secondly, what an embarrassment to the state to hunt an animal just because it seems we love to hunt. But to hunt an animal when we have an international foundation in Baraboo that is world renowned, has global impacts. And to me, that's an embarrassment for Wisconsin to allow a hunt when we're out here trying to protect them and save them and having a global impact.
Well, Steve, I thank you very much for calling. Paul, we haven't gone to you for a bit here. Let's go to you.
Yeah, so I want to say this. I love sandhill cranes, too. And yes, I have hunted them, not in Wisconsin, obviously, because we don't have a season here. I grew up and spent a lot of time as a kid near Clintonville, at a cranberry bog marsh, and I love to watch the cranes, and I still do in the spring and every month of the year. So even though I'm a hunter, I relish that opportunity. And like Todd said before, we're not going to, as a hunting community, we're not going to, someone used the word slaughter. This isn't a slaughter. It's a very carefully managed and regulated hunting opportunity for people in Wisconsin. And I love that the International Crane Foundation is in my home state. You know, people can be both hunters and birders and enjoy wildlife in many different ways. And so I'm one of those people who do.
Well, Paul, thanks for your comment back, and we need to take a little break here. So just a reminder, we're coming back, but our guests, Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schall are all members of that legislative committee that looked at the situation regarding our cranes here in the state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everyone who donated during our year-end member drives. It's support from people like Melody in Verona or Jolene in Chippewa Falls who make WPR's essential service possible. If you missed joining in, still time at WPR.org. And when you do, you can ask for your WPR wool socks for $15 a month as well. Thanks so much for your partnership during our member year-end member drive. Visiting about Sandhill Cranes and the legislative committee that looked at coming up with some proposals that we've discussed for hunting sandhill cranes and for providing financial support to farmers who lost money as a part of the depredation by sandhill cranes. Our last caller did mention something about the corn itself and sort of comparing the loss versus the amount of money that comes through corn production here in our state as being kind of small and insignificant. But Todd, you want to have a comment relating to that?
Well, I mean, I think on a global scale, national scale, maybe that is the question. But when you look at the individual farmer who is impacted by this and their livelihood depends upon it, that's a difference. And as I said, their margins to, you know, in the agricultural community is razor thin. And when you have additional costs or by adding Avapel or other costs associated with your product, and then you have losses, that's significant. And that has a direct impact on families, individuals, and Wisconsin has a strong agricultural community. So,
Dana in Shell Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dana.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. So I was wondering if a sandhill crane hunt actually happens, what about the risk of shooting juvenile whooping cranes, which are endangered, due to misidentification, especially if there is an inexperienced hunter?
Yeah, that's worth commenting on, and we'll probably get comments from everybody on this. Melissa, what do you think?
Well, like every time you put a weapon in anyone's hand, they should be doing it with the appropriate amount of training. At least that's the way I was schooled in hunting and shooting. This, what would be required as a part of the bill that was passed, that would require any hunter with a permit or a license to shoot sandhill cranes to attend annual sort of training or education. Just to make sure that that doesn't happen. That is a fear, because unfortunately some people shoot first and look second. So we want to make sure that anyone who is going out, if there is a hunt, has the appropriate kind of background in identification of these birds.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about the deer population here and the warnings and so forth that come out with our elk herd in the state. And
right.
Educating right. And telling people, watch out what you're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a number of emails I haven't gotten to. One was, and let me see if I can find it here. It had to do with a hunt. Someone suggested, and I'm just not finding it now, providing licenses for hunting only in the areas where there was depredation.
It's, So what we learned, again, if you would have asked me a year ago, what do you know about sandhill cranes? And I would say they're really cool. Now I know that the non-territorial birds travel quite distances. You have territorial breeding pairs, and they really are localized. They're not the root of the problem, at least from the data that was presented to us. It's these non-territorial, non-mating pairs, and they're going to roam. They go all over. So trying to get to the heart of that is a real challenge. Again, you're not going to hunt them in the spring, and you're not going to hunt them during that time when the colts are fledging. Really looking at a fall hunt, and that's when they all start gathering together. I remember seeing, you know, like the woman in Cable, just so many in the fields as they gather to migrate. So there's some challenges in saying, well, if this is the area where they're the most problematic, how do we best address that without harming those mating pairs, which are least problematic? Try to get those non-mating pairs who have a tendency to travel great distances to forage.
Yeah, I spent the summer at the Odana Golf Course playing golf from time to time, and there was a pair that had a young one, and I got to watch that pair and that young one grow up over the course of the summer and fall. It was really a lot of fun to watch. They pretty much stayed at Odana, I think, a golf course,
yep,
where they had plenty of help and food there for sure. And speaking of that, Walt in the town of Koshkonong says, not yet mentioned, is that cranes do a lot of good for farmers by eating pests like mice and insects.
That Todd? Is my understanding, that they like those things.
Yeah. Todd, you comment?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of positive things about sandhill cranes, no doubt. And that is potentially one. But if you in the agricultural community, while that they may benefit from that piece of it, they also suffer the financial loss because of damage. So, and maybe just step back. And Melissa touched on one part of that earlier with the whooping crane question. Is for Wisconsin to establish a season, I believe it's 6 criteria outlined by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the sandhill crane education piece is one of that, along with 5 others that making sure that whatever season is established in Wisconsin is in alignment with the current plan or a future updated plan, if that hopefully occurs at some point in time. So management of a species like this is a very fluid process, and it changes with time, it changes with new data, it changes with new information. It's an ebb and flow process. And then real quickly back to the whooping crane. Obviously the loss of anyone, a whooping crane for any reason, is a bad thing. But it's also important to know that there's never been a whooping crane shot by a legal sandhill crane hunter who's hunting within the season framework, is permitted, all of that. That incident has not occurred. Have there been whooping cranes shot by hunters? Yes, but not in the structure and frame of a legal sandhill crane season.
And you know what, on that note, here we are out of time. There's so much more we could talk about. But you know what I wanted to say? I was so impressed with all three of you for the care that you obviously took. And I hope that was true for all members of the committee, that you the care you took in listening and coming up with the decisions that were made. Some were for it, some were against it, but it was obviously something that everybody considered very, very carefully. And thank you. Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schaller, our guests today. And, you know, this is a topic we'll keep going back to as things progress.